After she released her debut album, A Record, in 2008, Laura Stevenson put a band together, played some shows, and started writing the songs that would make up her second record. She called that record Sit Resist, and it came out on Don Giovanni Records on April 26, 2011. Sit Resist has been remastered at Abbey Road Studios as part of a deluxe reissue treatment to be released on September 4th, 2020. Life's Work is a podcast about Sit Resist, a look back on the path of a shy kid from Long Island who finally found her place with people who encouraged her to sing. I'm Tim Christopher, Better Yet, and this is Life's Work. Laura Stevenson grew up in Rockville Center in Nassau County, Long Island.
Describe Long Island in one word.
That would probably be it. It's a dark place.
Long Island has a vibe, but in the early 2000s, it had a vibrant punk and ska scene. A fact that Laura stumbled upon when she was in high school.
My first show that I went to with my friend Katie, she just like found out about this like ska festival. And so we went, and I remember exactly what I was wearing too, because I was wearing like bootcut jeans and like these like loafers that had like a heel. Do you remember the shoes that were they were like Steve Madden's or something? And I was wearing this like purple shirt. And I was like, this is, like, cool, right? I don't even know, like, what I should wear to this thing. And Katie had, like, a cool outfit on. But, like, my friend Katie was, like, she and I would just, like, go and, like, explore together because we just had no idea. And so, like, we went to this show in this giant church, and we saw ASOB, and we saw this band, Channel 59, which was Dan Deacon's band.
Oh, wow.
And that was, like, I instantly was like, this band is fucking amazing. Because they were, like, absurdist, but also, like, really good, which is, like, what Dan has continued to do as a musician. And I just thought he was, like, amazing. And so, like, I had a screen name that was, like, had 59 at the end. Because, like, I loved Channel 59. They were, like, my favorite thing. So, I don't know. We just, like, all of a sudden we're, like, holy shit, this is, like, a whole world. And this is every weekend in different places, in VFW halls. And, like, it was nuts. And so we just, like, would get flyers and, like, and find out about shows.
Before he became someone who needs no introduction, Jeff Rosenstock was a front person of Arrogant Sons of Bitches, one of Long Island's biggest ska bands. And even as he's broken through to become one of the most singular DIY success stories of our time, he'll be the first to tell you that he's only continued on the same path that started in a vibrant ska scene.
I mean, there's the Long Island ska scene had people who went on to do really, like, big things. Like, you have Dan Deacon, obviously, who is basically the same person that he was when he was playing in his ska band, except now he's like doing these really ornate, beautiful electronic compositions. But like his persona to me feels like a very logical progression of that. You have someone like Justin Raisin, who went on to like produce Angel Olsen records and Sky Ferreira records and stuff. I think being in Long Island during that, saying whether or not I retained anything is like, you retained everything, so I don't know. But like, knowing that like next year high school was another high school with like five other weirdos that were just like you and your five weirdo friends in your high school, and then everybody getting together on like whatever church or Knights of Columbus made a mistake and decided to have a punk show that day. It wasn't like every band sounded like the Toasters or every band sounded like Les and Jake. It was like there was some of that for sure, but there were also just so many people just doing weird shit. Everybody who was making weird music would end up at these shows. I feel like ska was like maybe the thing that the equalizer, where everybody at some point like had some ska part of their song, and it was just how we all bonded with each other. But like, you know, you have Channel 59 that was like a art rock ska band in a way that was like more of a, seeing that band was like more of a happening than it was seeing like a band towards the end. It was more like a avant-garde fucked up experience at a show where you're like, why are they just playing a song called All Night Party for 20 minutes? What is happening? You know? I think, yeah, so I think maybe that did inspire me to just be like, okay, you could do fucking anything, you know?
Ska music ranks as maybe the single most maligned genre of guitar music there is. And the reason it's so maligned is because it's the least cool. But it never tries to be cool.
Yeah, for sure. And like, especially for me, because I feel like I was one of the more abrasive people to hang out with in a ska band when I was in ASOB. Like, so, you know, with reason, people were like, you're uncool. It's because I was uncool. I was annoying as fuck, you know?
And for kids like Laura, ska is a genre that passes no judgment and only welcomes.
So the Long Island ska scene was a bunch of nerds, I'd say. It was very geeky. And I don't know, it seemed like it was just the kids that were kind of smart and kind of silly from all the schools on Long Island. All the high schoolers that were just kind of like, maybe didn't have a niche or maybe played the trombone. I don't know. But I don't know. When I went to my first show and I saw all my favorite bands, I soon learned that they'd be all my favorite bands. It was just like, I figured out that that was the place I belonged, because I really didn't feel like I belonged anywhere in high school. And I felt like maybe the punk kids were a little like punker than now. The hardcore kids were a little, you know, more hardcore than now. And the ska kids were just like, go, whatever, like, come hang out and be silly and like eat Fun Dip and skank, which I never did. I didn't skank. I just kind of hung out and chilled in the back and watched everybody skank because I was too nervous to skank. Could you imagine? But yeah, I mean, that's where I saw ASOB for the first time, and that was Jeff's band.
So Jeff kind of like picks you up a little bit.
He did.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. He did.
It's the vision I've always had of him.
Yeah.
Just a force like that.
He's such a champion, like, of me. And, like, that was, like, before I even knew I was good, he, like, knew I was good.
Wow.
I don't know. I was, like, shy about music. I, like, never even asked, like, I really wanted to be in my friends' bands. My friends in high school started this band called Premarital Sax. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh, that's so dorky. Uh-huh. But they were, like, really good. And so I had like dreams of like asking them if I could like sing like backups or like play keyboards and like, but I never did it. I was scared to even like say anything. So then Jeff, when ASOB disbanded, Jeff was the singer of that band. He was like, I'm starting this new project and I know you can sing and I know you can play piano. Do you want to play with us?
Yeah.
And I was like,
that's a nice rub to get too.
Yeah,
Jeff thinks he can do it.
He always believed in me.
After the breakup of ASOB, Jeff started Bomb the Music Industry and his donation-based label, quote unquote. Bomb was prolific, extremely prolific, and strictly DIY. All the records were available for free. They set a $10 limit on all their shows. They even made a Bomb the Music Industry stencil available for kids to make their own shirts. Music writer and Staten Islander Dan Ozzy called Bomb the Music Industry Fugazi for the internet age of punk. But before all that, it was just Jeff putting together a band with some people he knew who were living at home, including the geeky kid who was too nervous to skank.
I don't know. We were probably talking to each other on AIM while she was at Skidmore, or maybe after she had left Skidmore.
I went to 4 undergrad schools while I was in Bomb the Music Industry because I kept dropping out.
Like, especially with Bomb having such like a like open revolving door policy of just like, if you want to be in this band for a show, fucking show up. We'll all hang out. Like, I think that was kind of a fun part of just like, we had a lot of friends who like, when they were bored, they could kind of hang out in that band.
I didn't get the college experience really because I was going to commuter schools. I went to one sleepaway school. What do you call that? Regular school.
But like, Laura was definitely like in it and in it for tours, especially super early on.
I dormed. I was living in a suite for one semester. You know, Skidmore, they kicked me out.
She pitched in on a bunch of tanks of gas and stuff when like we didn't have any money to do it, and it was very, very kind of her.
I just was like, I guess I'll never do music with anybody because nobody's asking me. And then Jeff asked me, and I was like, finally. Somebody. Yeah, and, you know, it gave me so much courage to then later on go for it with other people and ask them, like, do you want to play together? Do you want to... I mean, I don't jam by any terms. Like, I'm not a jammer. It makes me very uncomfortable to even think about jamming. But I, you know, like, I've asked people to, like, come and play in my band. Or, like, I don't know, Mike and I, when we were, like, first getting together, we were, like, kind of writing things together. We were, like, I guess we were kind of jamming.
I met Laura on April 26th, 2007. We were both interviewing for the same job at a music summer camp.
4 years to the day before Sit Resist was released, Laura Stevenson met Mike Campbell, her future bass player, partner, and now husband. And they met as counselors at a rock and roll summer camp called Power Chord. Is that not the cutest thing?
And the job was just horrible. I mean, it was like, it was 6 days a week, and the one day a week you were quote unquote off, your off started at 4 p.m. So this job, I think, really hastened Laura and I becoming very close very quick. You know, Laura didn't smoke cigarettes, but she would take cigarette breaks because that was the only like 10 minutes you can get away from the kids. And so I would go smoke a cigarette and she'd come and smoke one with me. And I did not know she didn't smoke cigarettes. And she just sort of like nauseaed her way through it. I was like, all right, cool, I guess.
Yeah, I just wanted to hang out with him. I didn't know why. I was just like, I want to be this guy's best friend. I like him so much. And that was like before, you know, like things got romantic. We were just like, I just was like, I have to be around him. You know, I like just would smoke cigarettes. And then a couple times I smoked 2 cigarettes in a row, just like hang out with him longer. And I got so sick. I was like, oh, I had to lay down. And like my nose smelled like cigarettes. My hands smelled like cigarettes. And I was like dizzy and nauseous. But, you know, that's love. That's love brewing.
It was just like, we just became very close. And on like a purely friend level, like it was just like, this person rules. And I just want to hang out with them all the time. And then I started hearing her music and I was like, oh, I want to play music with this person.
Mike also grew up on Long Island and he was still in high school when he joined Latterman.
I played in a band called Latterman. I'm not going to say pop punk. I'm going to say we were a punk band from Long Island. We were a punk band from Long Island, but we listened to Enema of the State a lot on tour. I'll say that much.
Latterman's short life had a deep and lasting impact on punk music. Their blend of earnest, melodic punk, socially conscious lyrics, and a tireless work ethic would serve to influence bands like P.S. Eliot, the Menzingers, and the Sidekicks. Members of Latterman would go on to form bands like Reviver, Iron Cheek, and Bridge and Tunnel. And not to mention Kudrow, which Mike started with Jeff and Dave Garwacki. Ironically enough, despite growing up in Long Island and being part of the region's respective punk and ska scenes, Mike didn't even meet Laura and Jeff until they were all living in Brooklyn. Maybe you could call the music that they were playing together punk or ska, but when you ask Laura or Jeff or Mike, they were just playing songs and playing them because they were having fun with their friends.
That earliest stage of Laura playing punk shows, you know, she was playing. The first time I saw her play a show was at this place called C Lab 187. And it was just like a backyard in Bushwick. And she was playing it was a Bomb show and Laura was playing. And there was a couple other bands. But it was basically just Jeff and John and Sean McCabe, who ended up playing trombone on a record. they were playing, and literally there's photos from that show where you can see Jeff looking at Laura's hands to be like, what's the next chord? Just like, no, really, just like there was no, it was just like, we're all going to play together. And if you mess up, who cares? You know, like, this is fun. I play on your songs, you play on my songs.
Yeah, we just had like just random characters coming and playing, and it never really organized itself until like kind of the second half of Sit Resist touring. It was just all learning about like the different players and their interpretations of the songs. And like, yeah, it just opens you up to other people's energies. And it just kind of like makes you just feel a little less uptight. You know what I mean? Like, cause I'm not like a control freak, but like, I definitely, if I'm doing something myself, I have like a way that I want it to be. But then when you invite other people into something, it's like, if you just make it about what you want and they're just doing the thing that you want, then it's just like, you could just be doing it all yourself. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's cool to have just other people's energy and people that support you and love you, you know, like I've only played with friends really. And I don't know, it just brings like a joy to it that I otherwise wouldn't have experienced, you know what I mean? And it just makes you better.
While some cool kids started websites and decided that anyone attached to punk or ska was someone to laugh at, sites like Quote Unquote and Dave Garwacki's If You Make It were forming communities around the music that their friends were making.
I think, I don't want to speak for Dave with what he was doing for If You Make It, but I feel like we're kind of on the same page of just like, I don't know, we're excited about the music that our friends are making, and we thought it was good. With Quote Unquote, it's just like, the records that I put up on there were records that like my friends were putting out that, whether or not it was like even my personal style of music necessarily, I was just like, everything that was up there in the early days was just like, oh shit, like my friend made this record and it's like weird and it's cool and they were trying to do something and that's awesome. And I think that just like extended to, you know, the rest of it. I think maybe it also comes from like, I don't know, maybe it comes from just like not ever being cool and not ever really like being the cool band or being like the cool kid at the show or anything like that. And I'm sure that's a feeling that Laura can relate to. Like, we've talked about shit like that before. And at some point just being like, well, fuck it, man. Fuck being one of the cool kids. Like, I want to be really supportive of what my friends are doing because I think it's cool and I want other people to know about it. And I just like, we don't need like someone else's club. We don't need to even have our own club. All we just need to do is just like acknowledge that like we're all doing cool things or just be positive about stuff that other people are doing instead of like being competitive about it.
Honestly, the community that Jeff's music kind of like has formed around Jeff's music, or that Jeff's music formed, you know, like just bringing all these different walks of life together, which is very cool because, you know, I was doing like quiet, kind of like Weaker Than Z, kind of like Elliot Smithy, like indie shit, you know, like there were some songs that had like a punk beat, but like not really that many, you know, and it was a lot of stuff that like, you know, younger kids probably would have like maybe poo-pooed or never wanted to listen to in the first place because it's like really like feelings based, which Jeff's music is too, but it's kind of like feelings based with like all this loud crazy shit going on, so it's like easier to access that, you know, like for like a kid that doesn't want to like deal with that kind of shit when they're 16. But yeah, I think it was just the community was just so open to me, and you know, having a record be out on Quote Unquote, so the kids already had access to it, you know, like I was just like a part of the scene, even though I was obviously different, you know, but it was this group of bands, these are the bands that I like, you know, like I don't know. So that was cool about Quote Unquote, because I could just kind of like be lumped in with bands that I sound nothing like. You know?
Some people look at punk and ska as music you're supposed to grow out of. But what if you just keep growing? It's not like you're made to grow out of yourself into something new. You all start somewhere.
Nervous Rex, like, in particular, like, where'd that song come from?
I wrote that one in November of 2008, and Mike and I, like, oh, no, 2007. And Mike and I, like, fell in love in October of 2007. Uh-huh. So it was, like, it was, like, new and, like, scary. I think that was, like, my first, like, real big love song. All the blurs of the sinking
ships are all sinking into your... What was the first of Laura's songs that really stand out to you?
Nervous Rex, for sure. It was actually the recording she was making as she was writing it.
I mean, I just recorded it on GarageBand on my...
That's the recording that's on the record?
Yeah, with the external speaker, like, yeah. Because I didn't know how to... I don't know. I still don't know how to use, like, a external microphone.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, on those old... Like, it was, like, a 2007... Oh, yeah, because I used all the money that I earned at PowerCord to buy myself a laptop. Uh-huh. So it was that laptop. Yeah. So it was, like, I bought it and, like... And that was, like, my first, like, music project on that laptop.
Like, the recording of it is her creating it on the spot.
And you can hear my mom's cat on it, too. There's there's, like, a cat bell. Because he started scratching his ear.
Oh, I was that's like, so
Ziggy,
awesome.
Quit it.
Yeah.
So I credited him on the album.
Oh, hell yeah. That's so perfect.
And I feel like it has that energy of just sort of, like, it's blooming in front of you. As you're hearing the recorded version, you're actually hearing the song's creation.
Just when they wrote it.
Yeah, and I recorded it on, like, the guitar that my dad bought me. So yeah. It was, like, it was really hard to play.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't, like, that strong of a player yet. And I was, like, trying to, like, figure it out. And so, like, there were, like, a lot of things where I was supposed to be alternating between two different strings. And then I would just accidentally just pluck the same string.
Yeah.
And that happens, like, a lot on that recording.
That's so fucking...
And I remember listening to it for the first time. I think she just sent me an email and was just like, hi, was the only text in the email, and then just attachment. And I was just like, my goodness. All the layers of vocals just convey so much intense emotion, like conflicting emotion at times. And that was definitely the first song of hers I heard that just blew me away.
When she made a record, or I even before that, like, I think she put Nervous Rex online and a Shine to it online. And I remember hearing those songs and just being like, oh, what? And then, like, and then hearing a record, the first one, and just like being like, oh, my friend's a fucking genius. Wow. This is crazy. You know?
Laura Stevenson was still the same nervous kid who went to a ska show when she joined her first band and started making records with her friends. Still the same when she made a record of her own with her friends and formed a band and continued to write songs with her friends. And that way nothing changed. But the music changed everything.
We were playing a lot with Bomb. I think, in my mind, the first real Laura band show was actually at Bill's Bar in Boston, which is no longer there. It was right across the street from Fenway Park. And it was the Bomb was doing a couple album release shows for Scrambles. And we played those shows, and the Bill's Bar show just felt like we opened with Halloween, which was before Sit Resist was out. And just the people in the crowd who were obviously Bomb fans, the response to us playing that song was the first time it felt like, oh, this is like, people are gonna like this if we record these songs.
I after a record came out, the songs that she was bringing in just sounded like someone who was like starting their fucking hot streak. I don't know. I wonder if it was just like after recording that and being the person who was around, I was like, I guess if I could play the keyboard or I could play the guitar part here because I'm here.
I guess I didn't really like think about how things were made because I wasn't making them, you know? But then when I was like involved in albums of his in whatever small capacity it was, you know, like just giving him like some extra vocals or whatever, I saw that you could make things yourself from like scratch. And you could create something really special.
Laura was bringing like really, 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 really great songs. And I feel she has ever since, to be honest with you. Like, it's funny to talk about Sit Resist in this context because I think Laura has continued on to make records as good and better than Sit Resist.
He like showed me that I could create everything, all of like the content, and then like go and execute it, you know, on tour, and I could just do it all myself. And I guess I owe him some gratitude. I owe him some thanks. I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for him. I say that a lot, but it's true.
Life's Work is a production of Don Giovanni Records and Better Yet. To pre-order the remastered Sit Resist, visit dongiovannirecords.com. For more info on Better Yet, visit betteryetpod.com. Next week on Life's Work.
Pratt University is in Clinton Hill, which is like, you know, a really well-regarded art school.
University or college? Pratt University?
Pratt University, yeah. Right?
I don't know.
We're going to make this cleaner for Tim
Pratt
to edit.
Art School. Pratt the Art School. What?
Pratt Institute.
Oh, we're both wrong. Pratt Institute. All right.
So,
I'm sorry.